netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. This week, Mike Seymour talks with Mark Breakspear, visual effects supervisor from CIS Vancouver, about the comedy Tropic Thunder. A show like Tropic Thunder had over 500 visual effects shots. And Mark and Mike will talk about some of the issues with that later on in this podcast. I just wanted to point out that you should, if you haven't been keeping up with FX Guide TV, we've been putting out quite a few episodes, starting with SIGGRAPH. Most recently, the Gamma and Density interview, the Pixar Render Man. There's a New Deal Studios interview in the works. Interview with the guys from PF Track about what they've done new with their software. And coming up, an interview with Ben Grossman over at The Syndicate, which was a very interesting interview, and anxious to see the TV episode for that. We'll also be doing episodes from IBC. John and I will be in Amsterdam for IBC, so we'll be doing a lot of new, fresh episodes over there as well. Let's go ahead and jump into the podcast. Tropic Thunder, like I said, had over 500 shots, visual effects shots. And the thing I think is most interesting in this is the approach that Mark and Mike talk about to visual effects for a comedy and how it's different and how there's more test screenings. So it affects the schedule completely differently than a traditional movie. And then also just the subtleties of producing comedic visual effects, and Mark will talk a lot about that. So let's go ahead and jump into that interview.
Well, thanks for that. And Mark, thank you for joining us.
Hi.
So it must be, well, I guess for most people it'd be kind of weird to work on such a photorealistic comedy, but in your case you've actually worked on a few comedies before, right?
Right. We came to Tropic Thunder by way of Blades of Glory, which was definitely, I think, my first major comedy. I'd worked on other movies before where I thought my life had turned into a joke, but this was actually supposed to be in the movie. So Blades of Glory was full of difficulties with having to have Will Ferrell skate at an Olympic level, and we learned a lot about the type of visual effects that you do for comedy and how that differs. So when Tropic Thunder came along, we thought we were prepared for working on visual effects for comedy.
So now you say you thought you were prepared. What was different about working on a comedy than normal drama?
Well, I think I was a compositor for a good 10 years, and inevitably, whenever you get shots, you always have two deadlines. You have your temp deadline, and you have your finals deadline. And life fits very neatly between those two dates, and you plan accordingly, and you work away. With a comedy, it is the studios of, they really want to know how funny is the movie. And so they test edits. And so they can't test a sequence that's got a lot of visual effects in it until it's at least done to a certain level that audience won't get distracted or taken away. And so when we did Blades of Glory, obviously you've got Will Ferrell and John Heder skating as the two main cast members. But in reality, what we filmed were two skating doubles. And so it's not very funny watching two people you don't know not act, but do all the moves. Right. And so for that movie, we obviously had, for our temps, and we had about 8 different temp screenings, we had to basically redo the facial replacement on every single shot, like 180 shots in 10-day intervals. And so, all at 2K. HD, I think, screened, but they made us do it at 2K, and we've given 10 days to do 180 shots every for like 8 different screenings.
Christ.
And so, you start off by saying no, and then they say, well, you have to, and then you get the boss to say no, and they say, well, you still have to, and then you give up and you just do it, and you kind of divide 10 days by 180, and you find out you've got like 48 minutes per shot. The danger is that you create these very fast temps, and for the visual effects team above you not to really give you comments on those shots to take them to final, because you have to do them so quickly that you're almost doing the shot twice. You do it once for the temp, and then you do it for a real temp and for a real final. And so when you work on a comedy, it's just you the first time you work on it, you don't really realize that you have to do all this extra versioning, just because shots come and go and brand new shots come in, and you're always doing these temp screenings.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that people also don't, I guess, appreciate unless they've worked on a comedy, which is that a lot of the great comics, Ben Stiller in particular, was is known for really working the jokes. It's not a sort of spontaneous, they just sort of throw it out there kind of thing and then they walk away. They tend to really, you know, study what's working and not working. And
yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And certainly when Ben was a producer on Blades of Glory, and we'd work with him on Night at the Museum up here in Vancouver. And so working with him on the third movie, you know, and I didn't work directly on Night Museum, but, you know, we knew each other from Blades. And working with him, the director, as well as the star of the movie, very interesting kind of difference to Blades of Glory, because my understanding of Ben Stiller came from watching his movies as, with him as an actor. And I was thinking, you know, well, maybe when we come to do this, he's going to be a little green around the gills in terms of understanding the visual effects, and we're going to have to kind of hold his hand. Well, that couldn't have been further from the truth. He was so astute, so brilliant at pushing visual effects just enough to, I mean, we all learned so much about comedy in terms of visual effects by working with him, the director. It was truly amazing.
Obviously, as you mentioned, Night of the Museum and quite a few other films he's been in. But this one was slightly different in the sense that the film within a film sort of gave you two different levels to work at, because, you know, there were points at the film, obviously at the very beginning, where, you know, one's meant to be, you know what you're watching, but of course you're meant to be in the hardcore action. And then there are other periods when, of course, the, you know, things can be a bit more over the top because, you know, you're like, for example, there's whole scenes that are sort of played for over the top comic effect. So there's really a balance there between effects that had to look photoreal and effects that had to look just bigger than life.
Definitely. And I mean, I'm working on Angels and Demons at the moment, and that is a very tough, you come straight out of a comedy, and, you know, I'm trying to not make Dead Pope look funny. Which, you know, is obviously is a bit of a difference between Angels and Demons and Tropic Thunder.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you imagine photorealism in visual effects being a circle and comedy being another circle, they overlap very slightly. And you want your visual effects to be photoreal, but they also have to be funny. And sometimes when you make a shot photoreal, it's a joke, like we had a shot where a guy was running along in the background and he blows up, and he kind of, in the practical plate, he blew up and kind of off the little trampoline and landed in the grass on the side. Well, Ben wanted to blow him up and make him sort of split into the different pieces. So, you know, we all thought that'd be quite funny. So we, you know, build in CG and he jumps, he blows up, we painted out the old guy and put in this new guy kind of splitting up. And we all looked at it and thought, oh, that's so funny. And we kind of split him into 15 different pieces. His head went one way. His arm actually blew backwards and landed on the helicopter, because we noticed in dailies that at one point the helicopter windscreen wipers suddenly turned on. And it looked like it didn't have any relevance to the shot, but we tied it in. So we had his arm hit the
oh, cool.
window and leave a blood spat. And then the windscreen wipers came on. It's just a little kind of interaction with the practical play. You know, all the CG guys, we all stood around and we chortled at the shot, thought it was fantastic. And we sent it in, and Ben ate it. He said, it's not funny, it's not what he's looking. And we were like, whoa, is he crazy? Anyway, we worked and worked and worked on the shot, and the end result was a lot less intense. His leg blew off, and it's dead now, and it does nothing hits the windscreen wiper of the chopper. And the shot's funnier when you look at the movie, because it's not trying to be more than what it is.
Yeah.
And that's the constant thing that, as a visual effects artist, you know, I try as a supervisor to constantly look at the big picture, or what's the edit saying and where's the story going, and, you know, I understand, but inevitably when you get told blow somebody up, you go crazy and you do it, but it's about the subtlety.
You actually got to work with Academy Award winner Michael Fink on this, right?
Yeah, Mike was great. Yeah, he came on board when we got into post. You know, and Mike was fighting the front line with Ben and trying to instill that kind of, that section between rotorealism and comedy, and find that mid ground that Ben was looking for.
You said he was on the front line, but you actually went to Hawaii, right? For the
I was in Hawaii for part of the shoot, to get, you know, with our CG artist and producer, gathering data for the various things that we had to do. Because originally, the movie was about 108 shots.
And most of those 108 were at the front, right? Most of the 108 were the sort of battle sequence?
There was mixtures all the way through. There was a big section in what's called the Hot LZ, which is the Hot Landing Zone, which is the first part of the movie, where if you don't know much about Tropic Thunder and you go and watch the movie, the first 20 minutes you think you're in the wrong movie. It's like all these actors being dead serious, and it's all gory, over the top, and swearing, and you're like, my God, I think I'm in the wrong movie. It's not really funny in the sense that it's like intense. You know, it's like watching an episode of Extras. You kind of, you feel really awkward. You know, my God, you know, Jack Black's like really serious. And then suddenly it cuts, and they go, cut, in the background, and you realize, oh my God, I'm watching, obviously, an absolutely elaborate, over-the-top scene from a movie. And we were in Hawaii because initially the 108 shots for the movie, we'd got the project, and we were going to do all the movie shots. And we were out there. There was the opening HLZ scene. Then there was a movie trailer, and or two or three of them. One was the Fatties trailer with Jack Black playing all the different people. Then there was the Scorcher trailer, which CIS in Los Angeles did. Brian Hirota did that shot, did a great sequence down there with the team. And there was a bunch of one-offs. There was Simple Jack, who was Ben Stiller playing a mentally challenged young man who... You know, we find out in the movie he was going for an Oscar, but he made the mistake of going fully retarded, and he should have actually only gone half retarded.
Yeah, that scene is very funny. And I must admit, being an Australian, I kind of recognize certain Russell Crowe and other characters. But that whole idea of having the trailers before the film worked very, very well. And you know, but I guess that those films were kind of over the top. I mean, those trailers were over the top. But that action sequence at the beginning wasn't. That action sequence really, you know, was just a good kick-ass Vietnam vet kind of movie.
Yeah, I mean, and when we were working there, I mean, they really went full out on blowing stuff up and trying to put the actors as close to the action as possible, you know, without actually blowing people up. And I think they did a good job. And you know, we were prepared. We built into design of the show initially a whole explosion software that we created in Houdini that we nicknamed Blow Me, which we thought was quite clever and funny at the time. And then so it was for matching the explosions that we had on set, these pyro kind of explosions, like these mortar explosions. And we had to match them, and we were going to add lots more in there and really kick it up a notch. And then by the time the cut came out, and you know, you don't know this at the time, so you spend 8 months in development getting this thing ready. And then by the time cut comes out and everything's looking good, we decided we didn't need them. And so our poor Houdini pressed by the fact, but this is where it goes. You know?
Houdini does seem very good at doing those kind of simulation practical stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It was perfect for the job. And we had a crack team. We had Carlos Lemus kind of fronting that, doing an absolutely brilliant job. You know, it was a pity that we didn't use them. And there was one point where we maybe, you know, had one shot in there. And there was this one scene where we'd actually added it in, and we were showing Mike Fink. And he didn't know the time that we'd developed this thing. And we showed him, and he started correcting and making comments about the real one, saying, "Look, well, look at this other one. It looks, you know," and we're like, "Actually, Mike, that's the fake one. That's the real one you're making comments about. The fake one is the one next to it." Right. So that was a great moment because, you know, Mike's a very astute guy, and I think he, you know, I thought that was a good moment when we fooled that guy. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. So let me just pick up on something that you said there before about, you know, combining the elements and selling them in. When you got to doing the finals, how much was it a case of a recutting exercise based on comic timing? I don't mean recutting the whole film, but I mean a basis that you just couldn't see things until they're in the context because of comic timing. Because obviously a shot does work in isolation, but then the whole point about comedy is, you know, the pacing of it. And I'm wondering whether there was any occasions where it wasn't so much about, you know, the quality of the work, but just the like length of shots or how long you had to, you know, the beats in the shot, as it were.
Certainly, I mean, we had a big shot in the Hot LZ, which was the helicopter crash. And, you know, we had to bring, for instance, you've got Robert Downey Jr., who's in makeup as the African-American gent Lazarus, you know, which caused a big stir. And, you know, he's running along, and the helicopter gets hit by an RPG, comes spinning in and crashes right next to him. It's not necessarily a comedic moment, as per se, but it was doing that and getting the timing right, because what they were timing, they're timing the comedy part of the story, and our visual effect was sat right in the middle of it. And it's making our visual effect, if anything, make a helicopter crash not take over the shot and still let the comedy that's going on with Robert Downey Jr. running through this mayhem not get overtaken by something that will take the audience away from what's really happening.
So on a shot, on a shot like that, what is the sort of what was the policy on putting a shot like that together? Is it to use green screen? Is it to roto? Is it to try and get as much in camera and do, you know, multiple passes in the same space?
Well, we basically we adopted the attitude that it's like just power through it with roto. You can't put a green screen in Hawaii. It's so windy that if you do put a green screen up there, it just becomes a big flag and flaps around. And, you know, you've got 7 billion shades of green on the green screen, and half of it's black and half of it's white. And there's a little. But you just, there's no point trying to put a green screen up, you know, unless you can mount it onto, like, steel. So we just decided, you know what, let him run through the frame. We'll cue a practical explosion and we'll jam it all together later. You know, we ended up slipping him slightly, so he was running at different timing to the explosion, because the explosion happened, A, a little bit too far away, and B, slightly wrong timing for how he reacted.
I mean, I know the shot you're talking about, it's a nice shot, and but of course there's that sort of fine balance of him being, you know, in the flames and in front of the flames and yet be threatened by them. Tell me, what was the sort of pipeline like? What did you do the roto in? What were you doing the comping in? We mentioned Houdini.
We used a little bit of everything. So for roto, I think we did it in Fusion, right. Because they've got great spline tools in that. And then most of the compositing was done in Shake. Specifically for that shot, it was all Shake. We did a lot of work in our Infernos, clean-up work, that kind of stuff. What else did we do? Our CG was for the helicopter crash, we actually used Lightwave. Worked brilliantly for hard body objects, and the way the rotos crumpled and fell apart, that was perfect for what we did. And we used Maya for a lot of the particle simulation stuff, and also we used Blowme, that software that we made for the mortars. We used part of that to generate some kind of explosion debris.
And I presume you're rendering in RenderMan, and
We actually used Mental Ray.
Oh, really?
We've run RenderMan here in UK and in LA, but the Vancouver office is transitioning over to RenderMan, and I made the call not to jump into that until we had all the things in place, and just based on timing, that show went through Mental Ray.
So it seems like it was a compositing intensive project rather than a sort of CG intensive project from that point of view.
It definitely was. I mean, the movie ended up having over 500 shots in it, which, you know, when you plan for 108, you allow for like 150 with a little bit of excessive miss in certain shots. But then it went to 500. And a lot of that was makeup fixes. A lot of that was unexpected things, like an RPG was left. He fires the RPG at the helicopter, and then next shot was he still got the RPG lodged in the RPG firing thingy tube, and so painting that out. Right. Or then other times he hasn't fired it yet it's not there and it's supposed to be. So there's all sorts of little things, and like, you know, on a sequence where he's running around for like 40 shots, that's easy 40 shots right there just for something silly. But we didn't handle all 500. We, like I say, the LA office did Scorcher, which was the flying, like the Ben Stiller trailer.
Yeah, I think it was actually Scorcher 8, wasn't it?
Scorcher 1 through 8, yes. And our UK office worked with the LA office to design all the icebergs and ice blocks and all that kind of stuff in there. The Vancouver office did all the explosions and the kind of, it was fairly compact. Like the end sequence, for instance, the end sequence with Ben winning the Academy Award, you know, we initially said we would tile people into that. We ended up deciding, you know what, let's just do CG people. We did some crowds for Vantage Point. We did a bunch of CG crowds for Blades of Glory. We just thought, you know what, let's do CG people in the theatre. So,
I mean, I guess the advantage is they weren't really moving around much.
yeah, they're not moving. That's the thing. So we actually have a mocap studio. So we mocapped a bunch of people sitting there kind of, like, just being very academy-like. And, you know, it's always fun. So, you know, trying to do that. And then we just put them in there. And, you know, about four rows back in those shots, it turns entirely CG. So, you know, the shots worked out really well. But so in answer to the question from about 4 hours ago that you actually asked me, I think the movie was a lot about compositing, but there were some little spikes in there that were, like, really intense CG, you know. We definitely expected it to be a kind of a balance, and I think at the end of the day it probably did, but there were some really intense moments in there for CG the sort of unexpected things that came up.
Just tell me, what sort of count did you have on, you know, bums on seats in terms of compositors and Rodo and people and stuff? What was the sort of size of your team?
We try to stay pretty small. Blades of Glory was in the hundreds, and we've really streamlined it. So it became, I think it was more like, let's say, it's maximum 25 CG and it's maximum 20 compositors.
Right.
You know, we kept it really streamlined, I think, for... You know, and that was to handle the anticipation of doing all the temps for the preview screenings. You know, and that worked out well. So at its maximum, it was like about, let's say, 50 people on the team, including managers and stuff.
Right, and when you say you streamline the process, is it standard to 3D track everything? Is it standard to? I mean, how do you sort of prep things? Because if you're turning shots over that quickly, they at 48 minutes a comp kind of type.
Yeah.
Like you must have a very well kind of built pipeline.
Our pipeline, we kind of came into the film world doing talking animal movies, and we've developed like facial tracking pipeline, which I think, you know, is so blisteringly fast. We just finished Space Buddies, which was another movie that went through our kind of, was a big one for the tracking department and tracking dog faces and everything. And something like 400 to 500 shots, and they track those shots like in a couple of weeks, just casted through them.
Wow, is that and using think, proprietary stuff, or is that using?
It's a combination. I think it's some sort of off the shelf software. I would imagine it was your standard tracking software like Bujou or the Pixel Farm, and then we've written some kind of custom stuff just to kind of take the data and manipulate it in a way that is useful straight out that we need, and also things for like tracking. Very furry creatures that are fluffs blowing in the wind, you know. And actually, joking apart, I never would have thought this, but when we were in Hawaii, all the wind was so strong that every single thing that was on the ground was blowing around. And we found out, and I should actually let the Bujou guys know this, that the software absolutely loves to track blowy grass.
Wow.
Like clumps of blowy grass track perfectly in Bujou. And I think for our next project, no matter where it is, even if it's, Angels and Demons, we're going to use massive pots of blowy grass and blow fans on them in the middle of churches so that we can track it, because I think it works perfectly. And I'm obviously joking, but I was blown away by how nothing in the shot was sitting still. It was all blowing around.
Yeah.
Yet Bujou just nailed it.
Wow.
On some of the scene tracks. And
well, that certainly is good to know.
Top technique there.
So thank you so much for taking time to walk us through that. And I mean, it must have been a fun project, but then by the same token, it must be also nice to see how well it's doing at the box office.
Yeah, it's nice. You know, 2 weeks at number one, especially after in the shadow of Batman. Very, very pleased, you know. So I hope it does well in Europe when it comes out. I'm sure it will.
I didn't know I'd enjoy a Tom Cruise film that much.
isn't it... honestly, Robert Downey Jr. and Tom Cruise are just amazing.
They are just extraordinary.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, brilliant. Tom Cruise's dance at the end. Oh, ruining it for people that haven't seen it. But go see it.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Well, thanks for that. Very interesting stuff. I think one of the things I've always loved about the business is the ability to switch gears like that between projects, that one time you're working on a comedy, one time you're working on a drama, a commercial, just a lot of variety. And I think that keeps things interesting, keeps things fun, keeps things challenging, which is what we strive for, I think, at least most of us that are in this business. So anyway, thanks for that interview. Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.